Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us to discuss the U.S. presidential election of 2020 and the vital issues that it raises. My name's Tim Kuhner, and I'm an associate professor here at the University of Auckland. I'm going to give a brief introduction about the current electoral crisis in the United States, what has happened since November 3rd, 2020, and why are we gathered here tonight. Then each panelist is going to speak for about 5 to 7 minutes in order to address key issues of their choosing, including the rule of law, the media, and political polarization. I'll then tie these presentations together in the end with a few remarks on corruption. But first of all, let me just welcome you and discuss the lay of the land in the United States today. I know I speak for all of us up here in the front of the room when I say how excited I am to see such a terrific audience in the room tonight. Actually, when I look at the numbers that have come in from all the various sources that are following this event, it's clear that we have the biggest audience in the history of public seminars. Some are saying that it's actually the biggest crowd at any university event in history. Now, the fake news media are going to disagree with that, but I say to you who came out to hear this seminar that you will never be forgotten again. And I won't allow anyone to demean this crowd, which came from faraway places because they like me. And more importantly, because they like what I'm saying. It's true. That might ring a bell, of course. You might recognize these words because they came straight from President Trump's statements claiming that his January 2017 inauguration was attended by the greatest crowd in the history of presidential elections. After Reuters released unedited photos showing that the crowd at Obama's 2009 inauguration was clearly larger, Trump went into a frenzy. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer pestered the National Park Service for revised photos until a government photographer finally produced edited versions that enhanced the size of Trump's crowd. Spicer then held a press conference at which he proclaimed, quote, "This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period." In sum, Trump spent his first few days in office attempting to discredit the media and convert his lies into the official version of events. And in fact, if you rewind back from that moment in January 2017, just a little bit, to November 2016, does anyone remember how Trump spent his initial few weeks as president-elect? No sooner did he win in November 2016 than Trump turned around and carpet-bombed the electoral landscape. Here's what he said on November 27th, quote, "In addition to winning the Electoral College in a landslide, I won the popular vote, if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally." And you can see the tallies here. Of course, Hillary Clinton won by approximately 3 million votes. She won the popular vote. But of course, the U.S. indirect system of electing the president and the vice president is based on total electoral votes. So it's possible, and in fact, it's happened numerous times now, that you'll lose the popular vote but win the electoral vote. And that's what happened to Trump. But he couldn't take it. So tasked with uncovering 3 to 5 million fraudulent votes to explain Trump's loss of the popular vote, the President's Advisory Commission on Election Integrity heard credible evidence of just 1,000 incidents of voter misconduct since 1948. 1,000. And it was disbanded after only two meetings. It did, however, attempt to obtain sensitive confidential information from voter rolls in the states that could have been used to manipulate further elections or to punish Trump's opponents, but that was also soon ignored. Now, all of us here could be forgiven if our memories of these scandals have faded over the past 4 years. After all, we've endured the Mueller investigation, the impeachment proceedings, and the many improprieties involving Trump's nepotism, personal enrichment and emoluments, now his tax return scandal, countless record numbers of lies, revelations of systemic racism, sexism, and violent abuse brought to light by Me Too and Black Lives Matter, forced child separation and kids in cages, and finally the reckless mismanagement of the COVID-19 pandemic, and surely even still I've forgotten to mention about 20 other scandals. So finally, the 2020 election promised to bring all of that to an end. And indeed, 79 million Americans propelled Biden and Harris to victory, That's the greatest number of people to ever unite behind a U.S. presidential ticket. And with 66% of eligible voters participating, turnout surpassed that of any other election in recent memory. Now, with over 99% of the results in, Joe Biden now has a 74-vote lead in the Electoral College system and a 5.6 million approximately vote lead in the popular count. These are not the kinds of results that produce uncertainty about the outcome. Biden doesn't even need Pennsylvania and Georgia together to win the electoral vote. He doesn't even need Arizona, Michigan, and Nevada together to win the electoral vote. That's how big his lead is in the Electoral College. Every major media organization, including Fox News, although they got pummeled by Trump for this, has called the election for Biden. So it isn't even close. Now, in other countries around the world outside of the United States, we could turn to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, essentially the U.S. foreign minister, for the news about the upcoming transition to a Biden administration. On November 10th of this year, a full week after the election concluded, Pompeo assured all foreign nations and foreign peoples that, quote, there will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. That's right. The Secretary of State has assured the world that there will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration come January. Humaira Pamuk, the foreign affairs correspondent from Reuters again, then asked Pompeo a question. She began by reminding him that the State Department frequently pressures nations around the world to conduct free and fair elections, urging the losers of those elections to accept the results. And then Pamuk asked Pompeo, quote, doesn't Trump's refusal to concede discredit those efforts to secure free and fair elections abroad? Pompeo responded, and I quote, that's ridiculous. And you know it's ridiculous. And you asked it because it's ridiculous. You asked a question that is ridiculous. Mike Pompeo. Actually, I think all of us in this room understand that that question is actually vital, not ridiculous. Trump's refusal to concede the election has plunged the United States of America into an electoral crisis that ought to remind us all of Russia, Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and other fragile or authoritarian democracies where democratically elected leaders have prolonged their tenure by violating the rules or changing them. That's a common pattern as well. Change the rules to remain in office, which brings me to the key event. As most of you surely know, on November 4th, in the early morning hours after Election Day, President Donald Trump broadcast his intention to remain in office regardless of the results. Quote, this is a fraud on the American public. Frankly, we did win this election, and we want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list. End quote. With these words, and now a series of lawsuits, Trump has attempted to stop state election officials from counting lawfully cast ballots well within the applicable deadlines, including deadlines that were validated by the Republican-controlled U.S. Supreme Court. And just this weekend, a full week after the results were crystal clear, Trump tweeted, all caps, I won the election. True to his promise to contest the results, Trump has brought some 17 separate lawsuits which have yet to enjoy any meaningful success. In fact, judges have been rebuking Trump's lawyers for bringing apparently specious claims, and it's quite embarrassing. Trump has also succeeded in getting a recount of the Georgia vote, which is ongoing, and is standard and actually due and proper in close elections. But that recount would never reverse a 14,000 vote lead, which Biden, I believe it's down to 13,000 now. Trump has also initiated through Attorney General William Barr and some 93 U.S. attorneys a nationwide investigation of voter fraud. But of course, the Attorney General lacks the power to stop state officials from certifying the vote directly. The Justice Department would have to bring whatever evidence it finds to the courts. Separately, some Trump loyalists are advancing the argument that state legislatures should declare the lawfully conducted elections to be, quote, failed elections, and move to appoint electors who could vote for Trump. So the results aren't final yet. Please don't get overconfident about this. Now, although Trump is unlikely to succeed in overturning the results of the 2020 election, I'd like you to consider with me a few findings from public opinion polls. Prior to the election, a full 35% of Republican voters believed the election was going to be unfair. Over one-third, that's right, of Republican voters suspected that lawfully established voting rules, many of which were passed by Republican-controlled state legislatures, would undermine an incumbent Republican president. 1 week, so that was 35% believing that the elections were unlikely to be fair prior to the election. 1 week after Trump's refusal to concede, a Politico Morning Consult poll found that 70% of Republican voters now deny that Biden and Harris have won a free and fair election. Republicans believe the vote, however, was fair in states that Trump won, even by small margins, but they're skeptical of the results in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Nevada, Georgia, Arizona, states that Joe Biden won narrowly. Now, bear in mind, although superior to Trump's votes, Biden's record-setting number of votes isn't the whole story. Trump received 73.1 million votes, over 10 million more votes than he received in 2016, and the second greatest show of support in American presidential history. And what this means to me is that there's no clear condemnation by American voters of Trump's first 4 years in office. Those 73 million voters have not condemned Trump's racism, sexism, xenophobia, nepotism, narcissism, cronyism, treason, untruthfulness, incivility, incompetence, abuse of power, and reckless mismanagement of the pandemic. Consistent with their belief in Trump's claims of election fraud, Trump voters may see the last 4 years very differently to how I see them. They may see the last 4 years as a reflection of Trump's commitment to patriotic, God-fearing Americans and to American greatness in general, as a reflection of Trump's tough stance on immigration and refugees, as a reflection of Trump's tireless support for blue-collar jobs, his family unity and healthy sense of self-worth, his close relationships in the business community, his foreign relations prowess against China and Mexico, his willingness to tell the truth regardless of political correctness, his intolerance of the Washington establishment and the corrupt mainstream media, his no-nonsense use of power, and his courageous action against the China flu. Perhaps most of all, Trump's steadfast defense of the American way of life against those woke socialist looters known as the Democratic Party. So I think we can now say, without any shadow of a doubt, that the United States is not just in the throes of an electoral crisis. The United States is in the throes of a democratic crisis writ large. With that introduction, I'd like to turn things over to Professor Scott Optikin, who will discuss Trump's troubled history with the rule of law. Scott.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you for inviting me to participate on this panel and for making the law school great again. Thank you. There are innumerable things that have disturbed me about both the Trump presidency and at present, his post-election behavior and those of his followers and Republican political enablers. But as a law professor educated in the U.S. legal system and now teaching in the New Zealand one, my principal concern has been the assault undertaken by Trump and his minions on the rule of law. So what does that mean? The rule of law is simply the idea that in democratic societies, people make rules, laws, to govern themselves using fair and agreed upon processes. And those same people then choose to abide by those laws and their administration. They also accept that the law applies equally to everyone, that no one is above the law, that lawbreakers can be held to account in some fashion, and, perhaps most importantly, that adherence to the rule of law is itself a value in a democratically functioning society. Now, among other benefits, the advantages of a society following the rule of law is that it lowers levels of official corruption, it avoids the settling of disputes by violence or conflict, it maintains checks and balances on the accumulation of individual and state power. Adherence to the rule of law likewise promotes open government, accessible justice for the population at large, the accountability of state actors, respect for human rights, and fair and appropriate lawmaking. Indeed, I would ask you to think of any society, country, or government at present that is not substantially committed to the rule of law. If you think of that, you'll find evidence of the very corruption, violence, lack of government accountability, unjust lawmaking, unchecked usurpation of power, breaches of human rights, and ill treatment of the citizenry that commitment to the rule of law seeks to keep in check. Now, it should be obvious that the rule of law is so fundamental to the notion of democracy that in a democratic country like the United States, the head of state, i.e., the president, should be rigorously committed to upholding the rule of law and guarding it zealously. But Donald Trump has shown no such commitment. To the contrary, he has in fact undermined the rule of law in five distinct ways. And in doing so, he's generated precisely the harmful and undemocratic consequences that I just flagged. First, Trump has himself apparently broken a number of U.S. laws at both the state and federal level. Indeed, there is significant evidence generated by the media, prosecutors, whistleblowers, and congressional investigators that Trump has engaged in tax fraud, campaign finance violations, obstruction of justice in relation to the Mueller investigation, and most significantly, violations of the U.S. Constitution itself. He was impeached for the, quote, high crime and misdemeanor, unquote, of unlawfully withholding aid from Ukraine in order to coerce its government into providing political dirt on now President-elect Joe Biden. Trump has likewise, in the view of many legal scholars, breached the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution by continuing to accept money from foreign governments via bookings at his gilded hotels and through his other businesses. There is also significant evidence that before he became president, Trump engaged in numerous acts of sexual violence and assault against women. His latest grift is an email asking supporters to donate money to help fight the legitimate results of the current presidential election in court. But if you read the fine print of the email, most of the money goes towards retiring Trump's 2020 presidential campaign debt, a classic bait and switch. Second, Trump has used his otherwise lawful authority as president to corruptly chip away at or emasculate the laws and norms of governance designed to hold him and the wider executive branch of the U.S. government accountable for misdeeds. He's wrongfully invoked the doctrine of executive privilege to shield his conduct from scrutiny, rejected the notion of congressional oversight of the executive as illegitimate, politically motivated, and constitutionally suspect, and he's fought properly issued investigative subpoenas from prosecutors and lawmakers all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Trump also refused to cooperate with the Mueller inquiry, and he fired former FBI Director James Comey in an attempt to thwart both the overall Russia investigation and an inquiry into Trump's own ties to Russian electoral interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. He's likewise fired the inspectors general of various U.S. government departments, retaliated against whistleblowers who revealed his various legal transgressions, and used his pardon and commutation power in conjunction with the prosecutorial authority of the U.S. Justice Department to protect, reward, and buy the silence of convicted political cronies like Roger Stone and Michael Flynn. Third, Trump has abused the processes of law to falsely accuse his political enemies of wrongdoing, consolidate his own power, and support his personal agendas. Examples of this include the Justice Department's authorized but wholly baseless investigation of some fanciful deep state conspiracy that allegedly implicated Trump in the so-called Russia hoax. That's still going on, by the way. The lawful but troubling appointment of political loyalists to key government positions, and conversely, the permissible but equally troubling firing or marginalization of government employees perceived as disloyal or whose actions threatened Trump's legal, financial, or political interests. He has also continually called for the criminal prosecution of his political opponents, such as former President Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, all on specious grounds. Fourth, Trump has employed law both to breach human rights and to engage in the abusive treatment of U.S. citizens and non-citizens alike. Obvious instances of this include the use of immigration rules to ban persons from various Muslim countries from entering the U.S., the separation of children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border pursuant to immigration authority, and the authorizing of federal police power to violently quell legitimate nationwide protests for justice following the police murder of George Floyd. Finally, fifthly, and perhaps most significantly, Trump has turned the rule of law against itself. He's done this by invoking legal processes that, while ostensibly aimed at upholding the rule of law, are actually designed to undermine and obfuscate it. The best example of this is Trump's current challenge to the results of this month's presidential election. As Stuart Gerson, a former Justice Department official under Presidents Clinton and George H.W. Bush, put it, quote, "While an apparently defeated candidate has the right to pursue electoral challenges that are authorized by law, it is an abuse of the rule of law to file charges that lack an objective evidentiary basis and that are filed purely for political purposes." Or, as law professor and former White House ethics lawyer Richard Painter suggested, Trump's electoral challenge is an example of, quote, "people who simultaneously embraced and manipulated legal norms, accusing their opponents of being corrupt and undermining the rule of law while flouting those very norms themselves." Simply put, Trump's false narrative of electoral fraud claims the authority of seeking justice through legal process, but in reality is actually aimed at delegitimizing lawful electoral processes in the service of his own personal and political ends. Those are the five. Now, Trump is, of course, not alone in his assault, those five types of assault I just mentioned, on the rule of law in the United States. For various ideological, political, financial, and personal reasons, Trump's attack on legal rules and norms has been aided and abetted by U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr, state and federal Republican lawmakers, other pro-Trump government officials, and, as Maria will discuss, a growing miasma of far-right news and social media disinformation. The point, however, is that the motivations of Trump's Republican enablers dovetail with his own to undermine the rule of law in the service of a narrative that supports their own rule. To undermine the rule of law in the service of a narrative that supports their own rule. Indeed, when the rule of law becomes simply a contestable organizing principle of democratic societies, authoritarians and ideologues, like Trump and many Republicans currently in government, are free to fill the vacuum with more nefarious organizing principles of their own. That risk to American democracy remains and will likely be the legacy of Trumpism for many years to come. Finally, and more hopefully, it should be pointed out that over the last 4 years and at present, adherents to the U.S. rule of law have pushed back against Trump's historically unparalleled assault on its principles. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected Trump's sweeping assertion of presidential immunity from legislative or prosecutorial scrutiny. Various investigative bodies have continued to scrutinize Trump's misdeeds. And as Tim mentioned, judges have dismissed virtually every Trump lawsuit challenging the results of the current presidential election. The rule of law will inevitably make Joe Biden the next president of the United States. And it may yet hold private citizen Trump to account when it failed to do so with President Trump. Most importantly, the rule of law will ensure a peaceful, albeit badly bruised, transition of presidential and executive power from Republicans to Democrats in the coming months. So there will be no actual coup in the U.S. And formally, at least, the rule of law will ratify the results of the election and push Trump out of office one way or another on January 20th of next year. The question, however, is what next? For the 73 million Americans who voted for him and his hard core of MAGA followers in the Republican Party, Trump's unprecedented attack on the rule of law will leave an enduring ideological imprint on their relationship to democratic governance. Indeed, the legacy of Trumpism may be a lasting assault on democracy and democratic norms that will continue to find supporters in future in the United States. This might well continue the crisis of political and governing legitimacy created by Trump himself and enabled by the Republican Party in order to maintain power for their own personal and political ends. It may also lead to more of the negative indicia that I flagged earlier in my comments that mark nations saddled with undemocratic rule. To survive, the rule of law and the commitment to democratic norms will need to reassert itself in the coming years, not only in the hands of Joe Biden and the Democrats, but in the hearts and minds of all Americans and American lawmakers. It's going to be a challenge. And we're all going to need to remember, as the old legal adage goes, that we are, quote, a government of laws and not men. Which brings us to the next question. If this is where we are and represents the challenge ahead, how exactly did we get here? Let me now pass the discussion over to Maria, who's going to speak to us about that. Thank you very much.
So before I start, I want to contextualize. I'm going to talk about how we got here and what happened in the media that actually gave us Trump, because I see Trump as a symptom, not the cause of the problems in the United States. But the context that I want to give is that I, in addition to studying American politics, I study war, conflict, genocide, and peacemaking. And what that context gives us is what the language has been in what Scott was alluding to in this, they call themselves conservative, but I kind of don't like that because they're not really conservative in the real definition of the word, but sort of the real right-leaning media. So that language and the framing of the political situation has been very similar to what you would see in war and conflict, meaning blame frames. So politics, as we all know, are very complex and has lots of things that contribute to problems. But the blame frames blame a group for the problems, one group. Now, these frames that they've been using, in addition, are what you would see in conflicts where they want to justify violence. So calling people viruses, calling people, you know, Nazis. And I'm going to read you some of the materials as I get into this. But in essence, it's really a frame of good versus evil, very black and white, and holding some people as the evil ones. And it's almost always Democrats, almost always liberals. But it also ends up being for certain racial groups or certain, sexual orientation groups. So it's targeting a group for blame. We'll get to that, and for hate. So the problems, as I see it, arose in part from, number one, the economic model of media, which is for financial gain. It's for-profit media, in part, not wholly. But secondly, also from the change in the law around the media. And one of those changes was called the Fairness Doctrine, which was supposed to, if you had a program on the public airwaves, you were supposed to treat issues with fairness, with truth, and give a diversity of viewpoints. So that was repealed in 1987. And what happened in 1988? We got Rush Limbaugh. And Rush Limbaugh, his model was so successful financially. I actually wrote down how much he made in 2018, $84.5 million, 15.5 million audience. So successful that it was replicated over and over and over again by these other kind of shock jocks who used the language of hate, the language of blame, and in some cases, almost what I would call a genocidal frame. Not quite. Doesn't quite go there. Parts of it, but not quite. So the Fairness Doctrine really drove the legacy media to steer down the ideological middle for the most part. It wasn't really left. It wasn't really right. They had some things that weren't really great for democracy in terms of biases towards dramatization and personalization and that sort of a thing. And they kept things simpler than they really truly are in politics, so people didn't get the depth of understanding that helps democracy. But at least it didn't, you know, incite hatred towards half the population. Well, that all started to change, like I said, in 1987. And, you know, on a personal note, I saw my own family. I remember getting into a car with my father at the time, who, by the way, is a PhD physics professor. It wasn't like, you know, he was not a reader or not educated. It, getting in the car with him, and he was spewing all this, like, ridiculous stuff, bile. And then he turns the radio on, and it's Rush Limbaugh. And I'm saying, Dad, would you please turn that down? And he goes, but I want to hear the news. And that, and for me, that was a light bulb moment when I went, you know, for so long, people have trusted legacy news. They trusted it. They didn't know this fairness doctrine had been taken out. And so what they thought was coming through their speakers was still the news, but it wasn't the news anymore. So this works, and Danny will talk a little bit about this too, I think, right? So this works in part because of social psychology, because of emotions that get evoked with certain kind of framing because they give certain meanings. And those emotions give rise to certain kinds of attitudes and sometimes behaviors, actions. And then I'll leave some of that to Danny. But so here's just some of the language, the really inflammatory language. This is from Rush Limbaugh. He said that liberals are raping America. President Obama was raping our values, raping our democracy. The Democratic Party was gang raping, and the American left, this is a quote, and the drive-by media would finally take us out. So do you hear the us versus them in there? Us versus them, good versus evil. They are a scourge, these are quotes, destroying everything they touch. Then there was the whole Hitler reference. And this is all like back in 2010. This is not like Trump. This is long before Trump. So as I said, because Rush Limbaugh was so successful, they brought about like Mike Savage and Levin. And Savage was calling liberals more dangerous than Hitler. That's a quote. He called them the HIV virus that weakens the defense cells of a nation. Bill Cunningham, another one, said, President Obama, quote, wants to gas the Jews, like the Nazis gassed the Jews, and that he was planning to create internment camps to imprison Americans. So this was like a regular kind of thing coming through, you know, 1,000 radio stations plus. And that, of course, made a platform for Fox News, which then came and continued this. So what are the results of this? Beliefs. There's just a few beliefs. Again, this is all from around that time frame, 2010. 20% of Americans believed that Obama was doing things that Hitler did. If they had just a high school education, they believed that in a much higher percent. 1/3 of Republicans believe this. 25% of Republicans believe that Obama may be the Antichrist. 29% said he wanted to turn the United States over to a one-world government. 25% said he is the, quote, domestic enemy that the U.S. Constitution speaks of. I'll let my constitutional lawyer friends here talk about that. So at the same time, you saw a rise in what they call hate groups. The Southern Poverty Law Center tracks these groups that they call hate groups, which essentially target like one entire sector of the population. A 30% rise in 4 years to 1,020 groups. Many are armed. Many are targeting Democrats with violence. They're spreading now these conspiracy theories. Everybody knows now about QAnon. But this has been building for quite some time and giving, like I said, permission or justification for violence. In 2010, again, there was a 300% surge in threats of violence to Democrats. To Democrats. And then we've seen some of what was starting to happen now with the attempted kidnapping of a Democrat governor. Now, then what happened is social media came along. And then you had, on top of this sort of spewing of this framing that I call hate framing, this unfiltered Donald Trump and people like Donald Trump being able to say whatever they want. It's only recently started to get labeled. Now, every time Donald Trump tweeted something really awful, like tweeted some really awful things about Muslims, you saw a rise in hate crimes in certain counties against Muslims. But then what did the traditional media do? They just printed or reported what he said, giving him a wider and broader audience. It fits the news norms because it's dramatic. So through this lens of, in the traditional media, giving him yet another microphone, they thought they're doing a service. And maybe in some ways they are, because it does freak out some people going, oh my God, this is kind of scary. What's the United States becoming? But on the other hand, it almost legitimized in some ways some of the things that were happening. So I think in closing, I don't know how to put the toothpaste back in the tube. I would argue that the airwaves and the internet do belong to the public, and that there has to be some public good to be able to use them. And there's got to be some way to examine these things within a context of free speech, right? We care about free speech, but the idea of free speech was that the best ideas in a marketplace of ideas would rise to the top, and that the truth would rise to the top. Well, insults aren't ideas. And so we have to really think about how we approach this. And I would call it not just a U.S. problem, but becoming a global problem. And so with that, I think Danny has got some insight and wisdom on this.
Cool. Thank you very much, Maria. I'm really excited to be here, and thank you all for coming out. So I'm going to continue with this theme that Maria brought up, that Trump is not the problem that we should be talking about. He's rather a larger symptom of an unhealthy democratic system. And I think if you look at the historical trends that we've seen over the last 40 years, Trump is really just a continuation of something that we've seen developing over quite a few decades now. And in fact, some of the foundational studies within political science and political psychology in general has argued that voters themselves aren't really ideologically motivated. When you ask a group of average voters why they vote for particular issues, they can't honestly tell you which policies go with which party, which candidates support which policy, etc. It's really just kind of almost like flipping a coin to see what the average voter pulls out of their hat, basically. So they're not like us who are out here on a Wednesday evening sitting here learning about politics when The Bachelor's on. I'm actually TiVoing it, so I'm not going to miss it. not really, but most voters aren't like us. I think that's one thing that we have to dispel first off. And it's led a lot of political science to focus on this fact that voters are, for better or worse, there's not really a nice way to put this, but political scientists have argued that the average voter is really just a chronic know-nothing. Voters don't understand politics very well. To look at some of the data that have suggested this, this is going back to Converse's seminal work in the 1960s. Basically, Converse went out, surveyed hundreds of Americans across the country, asked them to explain their party positions, etc. And what he found is that the vast majority of voters actually don't think in ideological terms. And in fact, most people thought about politics in terms of an us versus them type of conflict. So it's my party against your party, which completely transforms what we're talking about when we're talking about politics. It's no longer this competition over ideas, but rather competition over in-group versus out-group. And when looking more specifically at voters' knowledge of different political issues, etc., we see a very similar trend across time. So here you can see that about 40% of voters in 1980 couldn't tell you which party was on the left or the right of the political spectrum. And this troubling trend continued over the last 20 years. So these data concluded in 1992 with 41% of voters not being able to identify these basic questions. And this has substantial implications for how democracy works. And I think it moves us away from this idea that politics is about a competition between ideologies or different belief systems, and moves it into a framework of an in-group versus out-group type competition. Now, fortunately, social psychology has done a lot to help us understand and comprehend how these processes work. So Tajfel and Turner conducted this very famous study in the early 1970s and developed it later on in the 1979 study, where basically randomly assigning people to Klee versus Kandinsky supporters, this research group was able to demonstrate that the simple random assignment into an in-group versus an out-group created considerable intergroup hostilities. So these are groupings that the participants had no previous understanding. I mean, they'd never come across Klee or Kandinsky before. They were just merely randomly assigned to these groups and subsequently displayed intergroup biases. And I think that's a lot of what's going on in contemporary politics. It's an us versus them type of play, in essence. In essence, it's transformed politics into a horse race. So it's no longer a competition of ideas, but rather, how is my party doing relative to the other party? Again, the issues are not really relevant to most voters. It also suggests that this idea about politics being about an in-group versus an out-group, that affective polarization, so feelings about my in-group versus my out-group, are really what's driving most voters in contemporary society. And so here's some data showing basically that this is a long-standing trend. Donald Trump is not the problem, in essence. This is something that's been festering in American democracy for quite some time. So you can see all the way back to 1980, there's about a 20 to 30 point difference between how partisans felt about their in-group versus the out party. I think it's particularly notable that this is a symmetrical process. So you're seeing Democrats and Republicans having a similar pattern of responses, whereby Democrats don't like Republicans and Republicans don't like Democrats. It does, however, accelerate around the 2000 election, and you can see a considerable decline in out party hostility. And I think this is really the precipitous of what led to Trump's election. And you can see that the average ratings of the out-party candidates in 2016 was about 15 points on a 100-point scale. So how warm do you feel towards Hillary Clinton? Republicans said they felt 15 out of 100 towards her. Likewise, Democrats felt 15 points out of 100 towards Trump. So quite hostile feelings we're talking about here. So this kind of leads me to my final thought, or final point rather. Is there any upside to these previous 4 years? And the only way that I could kind of spin this in a positive way is to think of Trump as a hacker. So a lot of IT companies will hire hackers to identify weaknesses within their system. Donald Trump is the perfect hacker for American democracy. If you look at the various issues that Tim's brought up, that Scott mentioned in his introduction, and that Maria's talked about, you can see a series of weaknesses that were built into the American Constitution, a form of laws, etc., that Trump has thankfully exposed and identified important loopholes that we need to close, which begs the question of, will things actually change? On that point, I'm a little less optimistic. I think people have a basic fundamental bias to favor the status quo. The laws in the United States have been enduring for 200 plus years. It's not going to change on a dime, and I think it's really going to take the Democratic Party, in essence, to step up and take one for the team and limit their own powers. That way something like this doesn't happen in another 4 years. So with that, I'll go ahead and conclude and leave it back to Tim.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are discussing the crisis of legitimacy in the U.S. in the aftermath of the 2020 election.
I'm going to attempt to just tie a few of these very thoughtful presentations together. I would say, if we think back to Scott's remarks on the rule of law as a fundamental part of democracy, both a value and a set of institutions and procedures, Maria's remarks as about the fragility of human beings living in political community and our susceptibility to manipulation, it's essentially the opposite, right, of what you'd call a political community of equals determining their destiny together. That would be an idea of political pluralism with basic ideas of respect and respect for evidence and facts, even when those facts or that evidence is inconvenient to your personal interest, which of course is also tied to the rule of law. With Danny, I see similar building blocks of democracy, including the need for an educated citizenry and a citizenry that will engage in a bit of deliberation and a bit of critical reflection, making them less, again, less susceptible to manipulation and polarization. Now, we could talk about a few other building blocks of democracy, right? We could talk about equality, ideas of racial, gender, sexual equality, and that this political community includes people who are minorities who have different ways of living their lives. They might marry same people of the same sex. They might not marry at all. They might worship God. They might deny the existence of God. Can we accommodate everyone? You can also talk about the rights of migrants and refugees. You can talk about the need not just for the existence of an independent media, but for some respect for that independence, right? And not just indulging in conspiracy theories. So if you kind of go through the list, rule of law, equality, welcoming of foreigners, a lack of prejudice, a lack of bias, a willing to entertain issues on their merits, right? A willing to actually deliberate on the merits of issues as opposed to the blame game and so on. If you go back over the last 4 years, I think you do find essentially a decline or a deterioration in on every one of these different building blocks of democracy. And for that to then culminate with an attack on the electoral franchise, then we have to speak about the wholesale corruption or the wholesale undermining and reversal of a democratic mode of governance. Because that's really the cherry on top, right? To say, not only will I say some racist things and do some sexist things and do some xenophobic things and sort of violate the rule of law and insult judges and all this, but at the end of the day, when my time is up, I'm also going to undermine the vote. Now, it's all very circular because the fact that Trump is undermining the vote, I think, ought to be obvious to everyone, including Republicans, right? Let me just give you a few reasons why I say that. So I mentioned that Trump challenged the integrity of the vote back in 2016 when he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton, right? Well, he's made hundreds of claims like that over the last 4 years. And leading up to the 2020 election, he made a good 70 claims stating, for example, Democrats are, quote, trying to rig the election by sending tens of millions of ballots using the China virus as an excuse for allowing people not to go to the polls. He claimed that 2020 will be, quote, the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. At a Wisconsin campaign event, he said, the only way we're going to lose this election is if the election is rigged. It's the only way we're going to lose this election, so we have to be very careful. So Trump was seeding in advance, right, planting the seeds in the minds of his supporters that the election would be undermined. And it's funny that they don't see that as election rigging, right? And let me just proceed to establish a bit more of the case, you know? So Trump admits on Fox and Friends, a television show on Fox, during the early stage of the pandemics, he says, if you ever agreed to universal voting by mail, you'd never have a Republican elected in this country again. And then as Congress and the states move to facilitate voting by mail to promote and protect public health, Trump vowed to block funding for the post office. Quote, now they need that money in order to have the post office work, so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots. But if they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting because they're not equipped to have it. And then Trump goes on and he tasks one of his largest campaign donors, right, Louis DeJoy, as postmaster general. And DeJoy begins by reducing mail deliveries, limiting overtime, changing hiring policies, and dismantling mail sorting machines. He finishes by violating a court order to search mail processing facilities for undelivered ballots by 3 p.m. on Election Day. Then in a subsequent sweep, there were found over 150,000 ballots that were caught up in postal facilities instead of being delivered on Election Day. So, and those maneuvers all dovetail with those of Republican state legislatures, for example, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, that were trying to prevent the counting of mail-in ballots ahead of Election Day, ensuring that they could only be counted later in Election Day or after Election Day, which dovetails with Trump's statement, all counting of mail-in ballots must cease. So, I mean, I would think there's a prima facie and better case here for saying that Trump actually has suppressed and rigged the 2020 election, and yet a great majority of his followers believe that the opposite is true, but they do that by visiting conspiracy-oriented websites. So Here's one thing that dovetails with what Maria and Danny said. So prior to Trump's election, right, Trump's not the cause of all of this, but he has increased it. So prior to his election, only 25% of conservative respondents trusted the mainstream media, such as CNN, ABC, New York Times. By 2020, that figure, it had dropped to 13%. So Trump supporters get their news from Breitbart, Fox, One America News, conservative radio pundits, and so on. Now, this leads us to the point where instead of seeing the sort of obvious conspiracy, Republicans could listen to this at the Republican National Convention. This is Congressman Jim Jordan, who said, "President Trump has taken on the swamp, the Democrats, the press, and the Never Trumpers. When you take on the swamp, the swamp fights back. They tried the Russia hoax, the Mueller investigation, and the fake impeachment. So if the corrupt Democrats and the fake news media fabricated all of that, why wouldn't they also rig the 2020 election?" Now, I would take a step back from all of this, right? Because it starts to seem unsolvable. I would take a step back and I would say, you know, back in 2016, what did Trump voters think they were going to get? Like, what were they really motivated by? And 63% of all voters said Trump didn't have the right temperament to be president, but they voted for him anyway, right? And the main difference between Democrat and Republican voters in 2016, besides the usual things, the religious voters, the super educated voters going Democrat, the rural ones going Republican, the evangelicals, besides the usual party split, exit polls revealed that Trump won this pessimistic vote for needed change. Trump took the voters who ought to be siding with a people's party, a populist sort of Democrat, pro-union sort of party. 63% of people who said that life for the next generation will be worse than it is today voted for Trump. 78% of people who say that they're doing worse today than a year ago in 2016, 78% voted for Trump. And 83% of voters who said ability to bring needed change matters most, well, 83% of them voted for Trump. And political scientists Ronald Englehart and Pippa Norris, for example, say, when you get cultural backlash, right, the silent majority, the resurgence of racism, sexism, xenophobia, when you get that, it's often the product of an underlying sense of economic insecurity. So if you wanted to tie the rise of Trump to something systemic that's much greater than Trump, you might point to the truth in what he said about the swamp. You might point to the gradual abandonment of working class voters by the Democratic Party. How do you get all of that back? So I would say that the economic piece is something that would be a lot easier to work on than the ideological piece, right? So Trump isn't going to be able to pull off an actual coup d'etat, right? He's not going to be able to actually pull off like a military power seizure of the United States of America. But the most important thing in a coup, I would say, is not actually the guns. So when guns have to be used, they've looked at hundreds and hundreds of coups since the 1990s. When guns have to be used, the coup tends to fail. The key part of a coup is actually ideological agreement with the claims of the leader, which tends to be this sort of thing, frustration with the establishment that the leader is seen as combating. And if you look at what the Republicans said at the National Convention, the very first thing out of the very first speaker's mouth was, "This election is a decision between preserving America as we know it and eliminating everything that we love. Trump was elected to protect our families from the vengeful mob that seeks to destroy our way of life, our churches, our schools, our neighborhoods. Trump was elected to defend that American way of life. We'll build a future where America remains the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. That's within our grasp if we secure 4 more years for the defender of Western civilization, Donald J. The defender of Western civilization, right? So how does Trump do this? And this goes to some things that Danny was saying. So human beings, right, we have a need for ego justification. How does this work? So if we're doing poorly economically and Trump comes along and he says, it's not your fault, it's Mexico's fault. Mexicans are rapists and murderers. You're doing poorly as a family, it's not your fault. It's the fault of radical Islam. They hate us, they hate American values. It's the fault of China. So you're able, and then white families are able to kind of justify their economic decline and their cultural decline and feel good about where Trump's going. Same with the group, right? So ego justification, group justification. And then the other thing Trump says is designed to appeal to our sense, our need to believe in the country that we're a part of. So make America great again. American values. As a rich guy, capitalism, right? We want to justify the foundational systems that give shape to our country because it helps us explain how things work, who we are, what's going to happen next. It's called system justification, and we support those systems even when they disadvantage us. So Trump has kind of threaded the needle, right? But I think that a way to go back to this is to address the economic side of his populism. The other thing about the coup, right? So Trump's coup seems to be failing. It's been 2 weeks. He's not really going to get anywhere, it doesn't look like. But what if his primary objective was not a coup d'etat, not a military coup? He doesn't intend his second term to resume right now in January 2021. Actually, he intends his second coup to resume in January of 2025. That's the idea I want to lead you with, that the ideological polarization, the economic populism, and making America ungovernable for Biden is the perfect strategy to mount your second term in office, not in 2021, but in 2025.